It is Friday, March 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, four people are dead following a hostage-taking in southern France. China warns about its trade relations with the United States, and architects are working to make refugee camps more livable. It's all ahead. France's Interior Ministry confirmed Friday police killed a gunman who had shot three people to death during a hostage situation in a supermarket in the southwestern French town of Trèbes. The Islamic State militant group's propaganda arm claimed responsibility for the attack. Lisa Bryant in Paris tells me about the sequence of events.
First, there was what was described as a carjacking. The suspect had killed a person as he stole a car. Then this was in southern France in the town of Carcassonne, which is a beautiful medieval town. Then he aimed at about four police officers who were out jogging. He wounded at least one of them, and this is as he was driving. And he ended up at a supermarket outside of Carcassonne, about 10 kilometers away, in a small town called Trèbes. And he apparently entered the store. According to reports, he shouted Allah Akbar. He took hostages. And the next step was one of the police men who the police came to the area, and one of the policemen offered to substitute himself for one of the hostages that the suspect was holding, sort of as protection against him, being killed. And so he entered. They did the swap, and the officer apparently had his cell phone that he kept open, so that the police outside could hear what was going on. This is according to authorities, the French Interior Minister. And at that point, as soon as the police outside heard gunfire, they apparently stormed the store. And at the end of the day, there are four people killed, including the assailant, who's been identified. And the Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attacks. So that's where we are at this moment.
Was the suspect on the radar of authorities?
Yes and no. He apparently was known as sort of a petty drug deal, small-time drug dealer. But authorities say that he was not considered a potential, terrorist or a potential Islamist. Although it seems like, according to one of the reports, he may have been surveyed for potential radical tendencies. That's unclear. But he did apparently, according to reports, say that he wanted to have the liberation of Salah Abdeslam. Salah Abdeslam is a main, is considered the sole top surviving suspect of terrorist attacks that took place in Paris in 2015. We may all remember the Bataclan attacks, and there were several others. And so he asked for the liberation of Salah Abdeslam. So perhaps more information will be coming out in the hours to come. But at the moment, he was primarily known as sort of a petty delinquent.
And apparently the Paris prosecutor's office says counterterrorism authorities have assumed control of this investigation.
Yeah. And apparently it looks like there'll be a press conference coming up pretty soon, so there should be some more information coming out. I think that President Emmanuel Macron and the Prime Minister here are going to be coming out. They're holding a meeting, and they may be coming out with some more information in the hours to come. So in some cases, we're waiting to get more information, because at this point of time, there's very little information. What is interesting, though, is that this attack is very similar to a hostage-taking incident that also took place in 2015 outside Paris, or in Paris, right at the edge. And this was the first set of terrorist attacks that hit the city during that year. And it was on a kosher supermarket. And once again, self-proclaimed Islamic State supporter or member took a number of people hostage, and a number of people were killed, including that assailant. So the incident is sort of eerily familiar with what happened a couple of years ago.
Lisa Bryant reporting from Paris. Well, joining me on the line is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, what a week it has been, just even given the news today. And there are really a couple things trending today. Now, I've spent a little time out on the National Mall. Washington, D.C. is getting ready for a big march, protest, gathering, whatever you may wish to call it. Tomorrow, on Saturday, young people, high school students mostly, but college students, gathering to talk about gun violence and what they may think has happened. And, of course, just yesterday, the president replaced his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, General McMaster, with John Bolton, a controversial pick. And what's fascinating today is sort of the bifurcation. I'm seeing a tremendous amount of conservatives talking about how thrilled they are with John Bolton's appointment. He's incisive, he's directed, he's transformative, that kind of thing. And I'm seeing a lot of people who that perhaps might skew more to the liberal side, who are looking at gun control measures and looking, I guess, optimistically tomorrow to the march. The Young People's March. Incidentally, just by the way, I found this fascinating. Nobody speaking at the march tomorrow will be over 21 years old.
Wow.
I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing. But anyway, so there's a real bifurcation in discussions going on today. This is one of those days, I think it's just, I think there's a lot of, if you look at social media, it just seems to feel, people just feel unsettled a little bit and kind of, gathering around their roots, gathering around their, ideological, focal points, those kinds of things. So, I mean, it's a really interesting day, but it's hard to describe it in, definitive terms.
All right. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The U.S. charges 9 Iranians with a massive cyber attack against hundreds of universities. A Maryland high school student dies after a school shooting. 13 Catalan separatist leaders are charged with rebellion, and a report says Egypt's military lacks transparency. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study published in the journal PLOS Biology supports past research that suggests the more weight you gain, the less you are able to taste the food you eat. The study, based on research with mice, suggests that obesity-driven inflammation can actually reduce the number of taste buds on the tongue. There are 50 to 100 receptor cells in each taste bud. These receptor cells are said to have a short lifespan, dying off in about 10 days. As cells die, they are replaced with new ones. The researchers note that a group of obese mice fed a high-fat diet had about 25% fewer taste buds than mice in the lean group fed a normal diet. The study found that the rate of dying taste bud cells increased in the obese mice, while the regeneration of their new taste cells slowed. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a look at efforts to make refugee camps more livable. China announced Friday a list of U.S. goods that it said may be hit with higher tariffs. China's action comes a day after President Donald Trump signed a presidential memorandum initiating actions to consider imposing tariffs on a long list of nearly 1,300 Chinese-imported products worth about $60 billion. The move could limit China's ability to invest in the U.S. technology industry, setting the stage for a possible trade war with Beijing. VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide tells me about China's reaction.
But Beijing had a very tough response today to the actions taken by the Trump administration. They made it clear that they're going to fight these actions and do everything they can. They've said that if they're pushed into a trade war, that they will fight it till the end. They've made it clear that they're going to do whatever they can, and they have ample ways of responding to these actions that the Trump administration is pursuing. At the same time that we heard these responses, and this came from multiple places today, from the Commerce Ministry, from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the ambassador in Washington also was making these kinds of comments. But at the same time, the Commerce Ministry today also announced a more detailed response to these earlier steel and aluminum tariffs that the administration has sought and levied against, or said it's going to levy against countries across the globe. And for that, China said that if it's unable to reach an agreement with the United States soon on the steel and aluminum measures, they listed some 128 American goods, U.S. imports, that they would start to levy some tariffs on. And those included things like wine and fruit, also some steel and aluminum and pork as well, too. The Commerce Ministry said these goods amount to the punitive measures, if they were to take them, would amount to about as much as $3 billion in U.S. dollars. That would have that much of an impact on trade. So it's quite a huge contrast in what the Trump administration is asking for and the possible measures that they could take, which amount to about $60 billion, and what China put on the table today.
But now China is not just feeling pressure from the United States, it's feeling pressure from other countries as well, I think, in regard to trade.
Right. And this is, it's a little tricky. The steel and aluminum tariffs that the Trump administration started earlier this month, that hit everyone. And some of, you know, the United States' closest allies were going to be impacted by that. And so you started to see this kind of a divide growing. But today, after the Trump administration made its announcement about these new measures, it also said that there was going to be some exemptions, at least for a period of time until the beginning of May, for certain countries like Australia, Canada, Mexico, and Europe. You know, a lot of these traditional allies that had been complaining about those things. So it kind of seemed like we got off on the wrong foot in a situation where, like you mentioned, very clearly, a lot of countries, the European Union, Australia, Japan, and the United States, are very concerned about what China's doing, what they say are its unfair trade practices, how the field for doing business here in the country is not level. It's tilted in the favor, particularly of state-owned enterprises. If companies want to come here and do joint ventures, they're in certain sectors, I mean, in certain parts of the country, you're going to have situations where you're going to be forced to hand over technology. And this is in addition to all the other stuff that goes on as far as cyber theft and other kinds of intellectual property violations.
It seems as though President Trump has said he has a good relationship with Chinese President Xi Jinping. That, though, perhaps could change because of this.
Well, this is definitely going to be a huge test for Xi Jinping. You know, I would say it's really going to be his biggest challenge yet to date. I mean, since he's become president, I mean, there's all kinds of different things and different challenges he's had. But this is really going to test the resolve of his administration. And it comes just shortly after, just days after he has begun his second term in office. And we've gone through this whole process where we've seen him gaining more power and becoming, you know, more prominent in his position as the ruler of this country for who knows how long.
VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Today, there are more refugees and internally displaced people than at any point since World War II. 65.6 million. That's according to the UN Commissioner for Refugees. That explains why many urban planners and architects have taken an increased interest in reimagining refugee camps. Coming up with better designs can improve living conditions for the people there. As Faiza Al-Masri tells us, implementing such visions on the ground can also benefit the host countries. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Armed conflicts and civil wars around the world have forced millions of people from their homelands and into refugee camps.
At the moment, I mean, it's hard to always even define what a camp is because some camps are formal, where they've been purposefully designed and constructed, where others are more informal.
Brett Moore is chief of the Shelter and Settlements section at the UN Refugee Agency.
You might just have a collection of displaced families or a community that spontaneously self-settles. But at least those that under some kind of formality where they've been designed and or managed by UNHCR, there's around 420 refugee camps globally containing around 3.2 million people.
Living conditions vary greatly from one camp to another.
I just returned from Bangladesh and the shocking situation there for the Rohingya refugees that have fled persecution in Myanmar. And in the largest camp there called Kutupalong, there's around 700,000 people living in very dense, very poor conditions. You have other situations, for example, say in Chad, Nigeria, Cameroon, where you have displaced populations that have been there for 20 years or more, and they're still living something akin to emergency conditions.
From an architectural perspective, says social architecture designer Sama El-Saket, these camps often do not provide refugees with a comfortable or safe living environment.
Because the camp is laid out in a temporary manner, you end up running into problems, security problems, problems like dealing with sewage because no proper piping is introduced, there's no proper system of dealing with flooding, there's issues of sharing bathrooms between a large number of shelters.
Working for her doctorate in urban design at Harvard University, El-Saket studied seven refugee camps in Africa and Asia. She also focused on Al-Zaatari camp in Jordan that was opened in 2012 to host Syrian refugees, and where nearly 80,000 people are now crowded into a 5-kilometer square settlement. El-Saket says one of the common challenges facing these camps is that they usually end up growing well beyond original plans.
For example, in the Zaatari refugee camp, the refugees wait for the water truck to pass by and then hop on it in order to get from one side of the camp to the other. Another problem in the Zaatari refugee camp and in other refugee camps around the world as well is that the facilities and services tend to be placed around the periphery of the camp, making it hard for the refugees that are living in the center of the camp to reach these services.
In her study, El-Saket suggests changes to benefit both the refugees and the host country. The basic recommendation is to integrate the camp. When it becomes part of the neighboring city or rural area, the refugees have better access to services and live a more normal life. And, she points out, the government saves money.
economically, it is not sustainable to keep spending money on keeping up a temporary city, whereas if they spend money setting up a more permanent city, then refugees can stay in it. And if they do go back to their country, then the locals in that host country can end up moving into that city. And so it becomes a useful infrastructure. So when you're improving an existing refugee camp, the best thing to do would be to evaluate the current positioning of the services. So to move schools and hospitals and distribution centers to locations in the refugee camp that are more accessible to the refugee, but also provide public spaces like plazas and theaters and mosques or other religious spaces for refugees to gather in order to promote a more normal life.
UNHCR's Brett Moore says the agency is encouraging architects and other private sector experts to consider the humanitarian issues.
Yeah, I was really pleased with the work undertaken by Summer, and there's a lot of other students there has been looking at refugee housing issues, humanitarian issues. And even if we don't have the ability or the budgets to put in really significant work in the beginning, at least the initial planning process helps us create the kind of settlement that if resources do become available, that it can be upgraded over time.
Reimagining refugee camps can also raise awareness and the money needed to help refugees lead a more normal life during this challenging time. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thank you, Faith. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The ancient spring festival of Nowruz is currently being celebrated around the world by, among others, Afghans, Azeris, Americans, Chinese, Iraqis, Kurds, Pakistanis, Persians, and the peoples of Central Asia. In a statement on Nowruz, Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan welcomed the arrival of spring by gathering around the haftzin, cooking, feasting, dancing, singing, and spending time with family and friends. He wished peace, freedom, and prosperity to all. President Donald Trump also wished millions of people around the world a beautiful and blessed Nowruz. But both the Deputy Secretary and the President had special messages for the people of Iran. Deputy Secretary Sullivan said over the past year he has drawn inspiration from the Iranian people, who are making their voices heard by protesting for freedom, dignity, and respect for human rights. President Trump praised Iranians for the strength of their culture and resilience, which has allowed them to overcome great challenges throughout their long history. Today, he said, they face another challenge: rulers who serve themselves instead of serving the people. President Trump singled out the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, in particular, for condemnation. The IRGC is not Iranian in name or deed, President Trump said in a Nowruz statement. It is a hostile army that brutalizes and steals from the Iranian people to fund terrorism abroad. Since 2012, the IRGC has spent more than $16 billion of Iran's wealth to prop up the Assad regime and support militants and terrorists in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. Meanwhile, the average Iranian family is 15% poorer today than it was 10 years ago, and 30% of Iran's youth are unemployed. President Trump also excoriated the IRGC for corruption and mismanagement, and for repressing the Iranian people's rights to freedom of assembly, access to information, and equal opportunity. Despite the oppression they face, President Trump said, Iranians are fighting to reclaim their rights. They long for a springtime of hope, and the United States stands with the Iranian people in their aspirations to connect to the wider world and have a responsible and accountable government that truly serves their nation's interests. On behalf of the American people, said President Trump, may light prevail over darkness in this new year, and may the Iranian people soon enjoy a new day of peace, prosperity, and joy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.